From the University of Tulsa, this is Sacred and Profane Love, a podcast that explores how literature, philosophy, and theology can help us think more deeply about love, happiness, and meaning in human life. I am Jennifer Frey, Dean of the Honors College at TU, and your host. I invite you to join me and my guests, which range from award-winning fiction writers, poets, and literary critics, to philosophers and scholars from a range of disciplines, as we explore in conversation how the enjoyment of art might be, as the late philosopher and novelist Iris Murdoch has so provocatively suggested, a training in the love of virtue. I hope these conversations will enrich your life, inspire you to crack open some good books, and bring your attention back to what ultimately matters in the end. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Sacred and Profane Love. I'm really excited, one, to be recording from the University of Tulsa in our NPR studio here on campus in Kendall Hall. I think lots of you know that I am no longer at the University of South Carolina and that I'm now in Tulsa. But in case you didn't know, now you know. I am the inaugural dean of the brand new Honors College here. And our curriculum is focused on classic texts, such as the texts often under discussion in this podcast. And this afternoon, I'm really excited to be joined by Dr. Julia Hayduk, who is also a dean of an Honors College. So she's associate dean of the Honors College at the University of Baylor. And she's also a professor in the classics department. She's here speaking to our Honors College students. This morning, she was speaking about Virgil's Eclogue and Dante's Purgatory. And now we're going to be talking about Ovid. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hayduk.
Thank you so much, Dr. Frey. It is delightful to be here. It's been fun so far and looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I'm so excited about what you assigned for me to read. So we're going to talk about Ovid, but we're talking about some Ovid that I had never read before and that is truly wild. So we are reading The Art of Love, The Remedies of Love, and something that is just called Tears or Sadness or Laments.
Sad things. Tristia means, yeah.
The sad things.
The sad things.
So Julia has a translation of these three texts with actually a very incredible introduction that I highly recommend. This is University of Wisconsin Press. But before we get into these three poems, let's just start with a general, obvious question. Ovid. Who is Ovid? What's his historical context?
Ovid, yeah. So Ovid, I have to say, he was my first Latin love, the first poem that I read.
Exciting. First Latin lover.
Yeah, that's right. At any length, as a classicist at my junior year at Princeton with my wonderful, beloved mentor, Elaine Fantham. And he is really one of the most important figures, really, in the Western tradition. I mean,
why?
Well, a lot of things that are sort of household words for us, like Narcissus or Phaethon or Icarus, all those mythological stories, most of those actually come to us via Ovid's poem, The Metamorphoses. So a lot of the stuff like Renaissance art and Shakespeare, Pyramus and Thisbe, and all those things, they tend to come to us from Ovid's Metamorphoses. So he is, just in terms of the transmitting the whole content of Greek mythology and also Roman legend, Romulus and Remus and a lot of that stuff, he is just one of the most important figures in the humanities great conversation.
So people probably know Ovid and don't know that they know Ovid.
I think that's exactly right. When you think of, say, Dante, obviously Virgil is his guide. Everybody knows that. Virgil is very much a central figure. Like Ovid as a character doesn't appear, but like a lot of the myths that Ovid relates do appear. He's like the hidden force in a way for a lot of the transmission of the classics to throughout the Western tradition.
Mm-hmm. So that's content. Mm-hmm. Content-wise, Ovid has been important, but has he been important in other ways?
So he's also probably one of the like handful of wittiest people that ever lived. So it's not only that they were getting their content from Offutt, but I think a lot of great writers, including, again, Shakespeare or Alexander Pope or Jonathan Swift, Chaucer especially, it all felt very familiar to me because something about the tone of Ovid, both his eloquence and his wit and just his command of language, his absolute gift for irony, this is what people trained in the classical tradition grew up on.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk just for a minute about his historical context? So he's a Roman poet, but at what point in Roman history and where does he fit in all of that?
Yeah. So in a way, he's one of these figures who's kind of on the cusp. So his dates are from 43 BC to 17 AD. So basically, he is perhaps the one truly Augustan poet in the sense that his creative time of writing really was entirely in the period when the Emperor Augustus was emperor. A lot of the poets that we refer to as Augustan poets really were formed and writing their early works in the time before Augustus truly consolidated his power. So it was in 27 BC that Augustus actually was given the title Augustus. Before that, he was called Octavian. That's the date that he called the Restoration of the Republic, which we see as actually the beginning of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So Ovid was not, unlike, say, Virgil and Horace, he was not formed in the time of civil war so much. I mean, Augustus didn't like to say that it was an empire. He wanted to say, I'm just the first among equals, it's restoring the republic, and so on. So that's the historical context for Ovid. But it was definitely a time when there was absolutely an undisputed ruler of the Roman world, and it was just one man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ovid comes into some conflict.
Indeed.
With the emperor.
Yeah. So that's another really interesting little subplot here. So in 8 AD, Ovid was actually sent into exile by the emperor. And the reasons for that are, according to Ovid, he tells us it was a carmen et error, a poem and a mistake.
Yeah.
So the poem is clearly the one that I translate here. So the Ars Amatoria, the Art of Love.
Mm-hmm.
But what the error was has just been a source of endless mystery and fascination, and nobody has figured it out, even though people think that they have.
I mean, do you have a line? Or you're just like, no, we don't know. It's a mystery.
Well, I talk about this a lot in the book. I tend to think there are basically three kind of theories about what it might have been. One, that it was some sort of political misstep or scandal. There's kind of the political theory. Then there's some sort of sex scandal, maybe involving Augustus's granddaughter or daughter. And then there's he probably got on the bad side, actually, of Tiberius, who was Augustus's successor and who, at that point, was becoming much more important politically. I tend to think it probably was the last of these, that it was not so much Augustus as Tiberius who was really responsible for Ovid's exile. But again, it's really hard to say and nobody knows.
So the famous poet in exile that I always think of is Dante, but he was just exiled for politics. Really, it had nothing to do. It's just he was on the wrong side of a political dispute.
Right.
But with Ovid, you get the sense that comes out in your remark that it was a poem and a mistake. But no, it was actually part of his being a poet that got him.
Yeah. And the thing is, most of what he does, like he says, I'm not going to talk about this mistake. No, I'm really not going to talk about it. Like, I would hate to keep bringing up this mistake. That would really be bad if I kept bringing up the mistake. And I know it would be painful to you, Augustus, if I kept talking about the mistake. So this is a rhetorical figure known as a praeteritio, where you emphasize something by saying you're not going to talk about it.
Yeah.
But he never actually says what it is.
Mm-hmm.
He implies that it was something so unintentional and or trivial that anybody who was a decent human being would recognize that poor suffering Ovid really shouldn't have been punished for it.
Right?
But where he gets most of his artistic fun is talking about, well, he really was exiled because of this poem, because of his art. And the poem itself, its title was The Ars, the art. So gets to play the suffering artist who's punished for his art, both small A and capital A.
The suffering artist who's punished for his art. I mean, that's kind of an archetype for us at this point in history. Would it have been an archetype for him as well?
I think in a way, he's the one who kind of makes the archetype.
Okay, he's the original.
He's the original. I mean, he is the original exile poet. I mean, in his later works, we call them the exile poetry. And it is the kind of meditation, like the kind of Ur meditation on the state of being in exile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like the opposite of a poet laureate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Horace did it. He knew exactly what to do, what to say, whom to please.
Yeah. So we'll come back to some of the, I guess, sexual politics behind this dispute between him and the emperor. But I just want to dive in a little bit into, I mean, there are three separate poems. The Ars Amatoria, the Remedia Amoris, and Tristia II. Do you think of them as three discrete poems, but that are related?
Yeah. So the Ars Amatoria, the first two books of it were published in about 2 BC. Mm-hmm. And those are both addressed to men. Then book three is actually addressed to women. Mm-hmm. And that was published about 4 years later. Mm-hmm. As was the Remedia Amoris, the Remedies for Love. So in a way, you've got various different ways of grouping it. So you've got books one and two were clearly a unit. And then books one, two, and three were all kind of a unit. And then the Remedia Amoris is like an answer to it. So it's not actually technically part of the Ars Amatoria, but it's clearly related to it. And then in the Tristia, that was after his exile, written from exile. So the Tristia were written 9 to 12 AD, so much later.
Mm-hmm. And is that towards the end of his life / career?
Well, he dies in 17, still in exile.
Yeah. So the art of love, it's hilarious. It's offensive. Actually, the title of your book is The Offense of Love, which I take as a kind of double entendre, like offense, offense.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know how to describe the art of love, so I'll let you do it. How do we describe this poem? It's naughty, it's funny, it's bawdy, it's weird, it's offensive. What is happening here?
Yeah. Well, so it has, I think, one of just the funniest premises of any poem, which is the idea that love, which is to say erotic love, sexual conquest, it's a science that can be analyzed and you can teach its strategies, just like you would write a manual for how to grow radishes or how to play chess. You can do something for how to find and maintain sexual relationships.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but I mean, really, we're not talking about how to fall in love or how to find a wife or anything like that. It's more like how to seduce.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it is sex completely removed from its biological purpose. I mean, no even hint that there might be babies coming out of this act.
Yeah.
It is also completely removed from marriage. So he is theoretically writing for, let's say, aristocratic men who are pursuing a class of women whom they would not marry. So freedwoman or the courtesan class. It's not really exactly clear who the intended audience. He keeps saying, I'm not talking about married women. I'm absolutely not talking about having adulterous affairs or anything like that.
Well, he banishes the respectable women from the, it's kind of like in the Symposium when they kick out all the women in the beginning. He's like kicks out all of the matrons or the respectable women. And it's like, well, this isn't about you.
Right. Absolutely. No respectable woman should ever read this. Go get ye far hence, this sort of religious formula, which, as later Marshall, an even wickeder epigrammatist points out, which of course means that they're going to read it, right?
Yeah.
You must not read this book.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So why on earth does he write a poem about how to seduce vulnerable women for purposes of sexual conquest? Why write that poem?
Why write that poem? So here's the really interesting thing. Ovid is the master of irony, which I would basically define as what you mean is the opposite of what you say. Right? So if you read this poem straight, it's incredibly offensive. And it's just showing this absolutely Machiavellian, calculating way of getting gratification at others' expense.
Yeah, it would be like the Andrew Tate of the Roman Empire.
You'll have to explain that reference.
Oh,
to me.
My gosh.
Sorry.
You don't know who Andrew Tate is. That's great.
Just am I glad I don't know Andrew Tate?
Yeah. Okay. I thought maybe you knew a little bit about the manosphere just based on that one article you sent me.
Oh, right.
Anyway, I don't want to explain who Andrew Tate is, but for my audience, he's basically the Andrew Tate of the Roman Empire. And if you don't know who that is, you can Google it and be sad.
Right. I mean, I do know that pickup artists, PUAs, that whole game. I read a little bit about that. I didn't even know it existed until that's another story. Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, what Ovid is doing is he's exposing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's showing, because he is an ironic writer, he's showing just how absurd and evil that whole thing is. Mm-hmm. I mean, evil might be putting it too strongly, but at least how ridiculous it is. Mm-hmm. And maybe evil isn't too strongly. I mean, I think he was a good man.
Mm-hmm. So do you think his audience was in on the joke?
I do.
How do you know?
I don't.
Oh, okay.
And that's the thing. Were all of them in on it, or were just some of them in on it? I mean, clearly some of them were in on it, just because you do have some readers of Ovid, like Marshall, I already mentioned, who very much, he gets it. But part of the fiction, at least, or whether it's fiction, we don't know, that Ovid is constructing is that Augustus, like, didn't get it, right? That he took it seriously and thought it really was corrupting Roman morals and all this stuff. But I think the Romans, I mean, they were learned readers, were pretty sophisticated. Mm-hmm. I think they kind of got irony in a way that we don't necessarily always get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we struggle a lot with irony, especially now. But is he writing in a tradition of ironic wit? I mean, when I think of the classical world and I think of irony, the first person I think of course, is Socrates. Mm-hmm. That's one example of irony, not put to poetic use, but philosophical use. Mm-hmm. Is he drawing on that, or are there other traditions that he's drawing on?
Yeah, that's a great question. Part of the problem, of course, is that so much of this stuff has been lost, that there may well have been other ironic writers that we know not of. I think that, in a way, I don't want to say he's the pioneer, but he certainly brought that kind of writing to his perfection. One of the things that he also is just a brilliant reader and a brilliant literary critic of all kinds of genres. Mm-hmm. So what he's doing is he's combining, say, the genre of didactic poetry. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are tragic parts that are like tragedy, and then there's parts that bring in comedy. And then he's definitely writing, there was a brief flowering of erotic elegy in Rome. And that is coming from an earlier Greek tradition that Ovid himself wrote.
What is erotic elegy?
So what is erotic elegy? Okay, so elegy, it's a generic term, generic as in having to do with genre, for poems that are written in elegiac couplets, which is a hexameter, a 6-foot line, combined with a pentameter, a 5-foot line. And it was a genre that was originally associated with lament, which also comes to be used for erotic poetry, for love poetry and epigrams and so on. Mm-hmm. So Ovid is writing in that tradition. Mm-hmm. The other great love elegists, there was a guy named Gallus who actually was forced to commit suicide for political reasons, not because of his poems. And then Propertius and Tibullus and Ovid are the big four for elegy.
Yeah. So I think in your introduction, you call it erotodidactic, because the idea is like you're a professor of love or a teacher of love, where again, love means seduction,
right?
Of somewhat unwitting or only half willing, not respectable women for your own conquest. I mean, in that respect, it kind of reminds me of a Don Juan figure just out to get as much as he can. But I think there's this obvious kind of absurd undertones to the whole thing. And I think part of that is just the idea that this is a serious science or something.
Right.
That this would be something that you would study. What's he doing there?
Well, part of the joke is that if it is a science, let's assume it's a science, what is your data? And his data includes both observation of human beings, but even more, it's like the whole realm of literature. So he's looking at epic and tragedy and comedy and Roman history and all of these things, and that's his data. But imagine trying to do a sociological study where your data is, say, the plays of Shakespeare or something. There's this sort of mismatch between the obvious, you're working with all these different genres that have their own ways of speaking, their own artistic aims, all these things. And you're just trying to take it straight and fit it into the mold of this scientific study that you're doing. So there's this huge mismatch between the data that he's using, which is basically all of mythology and literature and history, and his didactic technical study that he's doing.
So one question that I had when I was reading this, and I was just giggling the whole time.
That's good.
What is the reader supposed to get out of it beyond entertainment? So I was imagining different possibilities. This could be a send up of the entire idea that art is didactic. It could just be making fun of that.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a subtle teaching where if this is all ironic, then it's telling you what not to do or mm-hmm. something.
Mm-hmm.
So it is still somehow didactic. Or what? These were questions running through my mind as I was reading it, because I was like, well, what does the clever reader, the good reader, take from this?
Right. Well, this poem has never been more relevant than it is in 2023.
Oh, okay, that's a big claim. Yeah, why?
Yeah, because so much of what he is doing, he's talking about the artifaction of the self, the curation of the self, the idea that in order to appear natural and spontaneous, it requires a tremendous amount of art, mm-hmm. right? That's just basically what social media is all about. All of his instructions, both to men and women, are how to take you and create through art this persona or facade that is going to help you to get this thing that you want, right? How to seduce people.
Yeah, because if you're seducing someone, you're manipulating them.
Right.
Right. You're just doing whatever it takes to bring their will to yours.
Exactly.
Right. And it just turns out that in this case, that's having sex. But manipulation can take many forms. It just depends on what you want to manipulate the person to do.
Right.
So the idea is how to carefully construct yourself so that you are the master manipulator.
Exactly.
So it's like working on your brand, but the goal isn't making money, but sexual conquest.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, if that's what's happening in the poem, then the one who reads the poem well takes what from that?
I hope it helps them to laugh at themselves. I hope it helps them to recognize that this is what is going on. One of the things that Ovid is just, he's an incredible myth maker, mythographer, teller, conveyor of myth. And two of the most important myths, I think, for his work and for our time are the myths of Narcissus and Pygmalion, both mm-hmm. of which are very much presented in similar terms and shown as a pair mm-hmm. in the Metamorphoses. And he doesn't actually talk about them in the Ars Amatoria, but I think they are very much underlying what he's doing.
Do you want to just very briefly run through those?
Sure. So Narcissus is this beautiful youth who his mother goes to the seer Tiresias when Narcissus is a baby, and he's the most beautiful baby. So tell me his future. Will he have a long life? And Tiresias says he will, as long as he doesn't know himself. Do, do, do. So what happens is Narcissus is basically cursed for rebuffing somebody, that he will, when he looks upon his own image in a pond, he will fall in love with himself and not be able to tear himself away from it. Mm-hmm. So he just looks into the pond and he doesn't eat and he doesn't sleep. At first he thinks it's someone else, but finally he realizes, oh, wait a minute, it's me. Mm-hmm. And it's that, oh, it's so powerful to me because I just think of people, us today, like looking into this screen, this flat screen, like the surface of a pond. And what we see is ourself reflected back to ourself. But what it leads to is annihilation, that you can't actually know yourself by looking in the mirror. Mm-hmm. You only come to know yourself by looking outside of yourself. So there's that. And then Pygmalion was the artist who, he scorned actual living women because he was disgusted with them, but he created this statue that was so beautiful that he fell in love with it. And he started treating it like his girlfriend and giving it gifts and all these things. And at the end of the story, it seems like kind of a happy ending. He prays to the goddess Venus and she makes the statue come to life. So this creation that was entirely basically just a projection of his own fantasy of the ideal woman then becomes his wife. Mm-hmm. But you think, like, what kind of inner life must she have had?
Right.
Just this pure physical beauty is the only thing she could possibly have offered. And not even a beauty that was like actually her own, but just a beauty that he created.
I'm kind of wondering how much Plato's behind all of this. Mm-hmm. I was wondering that the whole time that I was reading it, just keeping in mind that it's a farce or it's deeply ironic or it's satire. We haven't talked about satire yet. We should get to that. But if you think about Plato's account of love, I mean, one, you're not in total control. One part of the absurdity is this idea that love is something that you control, that it's about manipulation.
Right.
Because, of course, that's already the opposite of love. And when we're talking about eros, in Plato's sense, it's something that strikes you.
Right.
Right. And it's also something that starts out at the level of beautiful bodies, right? But is not meant to end there.
Right.
Right. It is meant to ascend. Ultimately to the deepest realities.
The good, right.
Right, yeah. So it ascends and it gets more transcendent as it goes, right? So that at the end of it, you're just gazing at the form of beauty itself.
Right.
Right, which is not you.
Right.
Right. But that is what, as it were, completes or perfects you. It's not accidental that at the end of it, that it takes you straight to beauty. And is a contemplative thing.
And yet right. For Plato, the whole idea is that there are these forms of which our world is the shadow or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that sort of Platonic idea of this ladder, part of this running joke is that instead of reaching the form of the good at the end, you get a good time.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Right. That's the ultimate goal. But what you also said about that we can't actually control Eros, that Eros is this wild, uncontrollable force, that actually is another message that Ovid does give us, right? Mm-hmm. He says at the beginning, I'm going to show Eros who's boss. Cupid's just a boy. I can steer him. I can control this. And yet the ultimate message, and this is, again, getting to the remedies for love. He's saying, well, you know, you're in love. You don't really want to be. So how do you get out of love? That's the basic idea. The whole message of that poem is that no matter how hard you try, you can't. You can't actually control this force. The whole idea that love was just something that you could control and manipulate is shown to be false.
Right. I mean, it is to denature and destroy the very movement of love, which is like it strikes you, it's receptive. You can't choose to fall in love, right? You can't just be like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to fall in love with you.
Yep.
It doesn't work that way. It would be much simpler. Or if your parents could command you to fall in love with that guy. He's a good one. I mean, that would be nice, frankly, as a parent. But it doesn't work that way. You're not really in charge of that. But then also, and this gets back to what you were saying about Narcissus and Pygmalion, the movement of love is precisely away from the self. Right?
Right.
So if it stayed at the level of bodily pleasure, which is yours, two people can both experience bodily pleasure by doing things to one another, but it's still your pleasure, like at the end of the day.
Right.
It's not a common good. Whereas the love between two people is shared, just participated in necessarily by both of them. So it's like, love is literally taking you out of yourself. Seduction is not.
No.
All seduction is doing is manipulating someone back to you for your sake.
Right.
So it does seem narcissistic.
Right. I mean, throughout the Ars Amatoria, there's not the slightest hint of you're actually doing something good for the other. It's all about your gratification and how you can pretend that you're doing something for them, but actually getting something for you. So it's just exposing in its rawest form. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what pornography is, right? And scopophilia and looking at screens where they can't look at you. I mean, you're mm-hmm. getting something. You're not giving any of yourself.
Right. Right. So then is it erotodidactic after all, but just in the opposite way that it initially seemed?
Teaching us what love really is?
Yeah.
The opposite of what I'm saying?
By showing us what it's not. I mean, is that, or is it sending up the whole idea that there's a didacticism here to be engaged in?
Well, this is one of the things that makes it so fascinating. I think you can see it either way. I mean, what's really interesting is when people read this poem and don't recognize that it's ironic.
Yeah, I think that happens because, as I told you earlier today, I was just listening to BBC's In Our Time, and they talked about this poem, and boy, they didn't seem to think it was ironic.
That's like reading Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal and saying, wow, maybe really we should use Irish babies for food. The whole point is he means the opposite of what he's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just reporting. not endorsing.
But yeah. The thing is, Ovid's so good, though. He's so good that he does draw you in. He also is performing the very seduction that he is teaching. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the things, like the really interesting things he does at the end of book three, he tells this story of Cephalus and Procris. And it's portrayed as this beautiful, tragic love story and how he thinks she's a wild animal and he throws his spear at her and accidentally kills her. And if you know the backstory, if you know the story from other sources, you know that Cephalus and Procris were like the paradigm of adultery and deception. And both of them tried to seduce the other person in disguise, and they were fooling around with other people, and there's all this other stuff. What Ovid has done is he has turned that extremely sordid tale into a tragic love story. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, he's showing us, hey, look what art can do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the reader is getting seduced along with the person that Ovid is trying to do. So it's a meditation not just on love, but also on the power of art mm-hmm. and the power of human or the propensity of humans to believe what they want to believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you had to summarize briefly what you think Ovid thinks the power of art is, what would you say?
Oh, wow. Well, so I think Ovid, and this is a thread that runs throughout Ovid's poetry. The muse was his lover. So he has the kind of relationship with his muse that the elegiac poets have with their girlfriend. Odie et amo, I hate and I love. Mm-hmm. Can't live with him, can't live without him. Mm-hmm. And that very much comes out in the exile poetry, where the theme is that it was because of his muse that he was exiled. And yet his muse, his art is the one thing that's keeping him going. Mm-hmm. In this frozen wasteland where he now is. Mm-hmm. So I think that for Ovid, art is, it is the source of transcendence mm-hmm. in human life. Mm-hmm. It is his love. And I think that this love and art for him were very much fused. He was in love with his
beauty?
Art. With beauty, with his art. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with poetry.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the remedies of love. Mm-hmm. So if the art of love functions in an ironic way, showing you how not to love, how do the remedies of love fit into that?
Yeah.
Is this the medicine you shouldn't take?
In a sense, right. So the conceit of the work is that, okay, so now you've taken my course, you've done my art of love, and oh, now it's worked a little too well. So now you're in love. So now I'm going to teach you how to get out of love. So now I'll be the know-it-all doctor instead.
So now he's curing.
So now he's going to cure you of your love, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things that happens throughout the Ars Amatoria is it is chock full of metaphors. So there's all kinds of metaphors for erotic seduction and activity. Chief among them are war, battle of the sexes, hunting, and farming, and then there's like some fishing and bird catching and whatever.
Chariot racing,
right, all those things. So some of the advice that he gives you in The Remedies for Love, if you want to fall out of love, go to war. Make war, not love. That's a great way to fall out of love. Mm. Or if that doesn't work, maybe you could try hunting or farming.
Yeah, it's like, why don't you try to plow? Yeah, that's hard.
Try to plow. But the problem is that he has so completely elegized the world, right? He has, that's kind of the running joke, that everything is about sex. War is about sex. Hunting is about sex. Farming is about sex. It's all about sex. That is what he has done in the first three books. So then to try to get you to fall out of love, well, do all these things. Except he's already shown you that they're all about sex, too.
So there are no remedies?
That kind of is the punchline.
Right? Yeah.
There is no remedy.
Yeah. Let's talk about the sad things because, and I don't know what this says about me, but I actually thought that was the funniest of them all.
That's great.
Because he's just like, it's hard to describe, but he's basically like, hey, I was your biggest fan. I didn't really do anything wrong. What's your problem? Other writers don't get punished for writing dirty stuff. It's like a weird long argument.
Well, it's the cheekiest pseudo-apology ever, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry if I offended you.
It is sorry, not sorry.
Exactly.
Right? It's just like, I could not be less sorry about any of it. I thought it was hilarious. I couldn't stop laughing.
Oh, good.
But was also like just a little bit perplexed. I mean, is it just the final middle finger to the emperor or what?
Well, again, that's the thing. Most people, I think, would read it as like he really was trying to return from exile. He really was trying to get the emperor to be sympathetic to him and bring him back.
Oh, that can't be right. Really? You think?
I don't think it was.
He's just really got so many bangers in this one. I love, be merciful. If Jupiter were to send his thunderbolts every time humans sin, in a short time, he'll be unarmed. He's like, why are you singling me out?
Yeah. And it's Augustus as Jupiter, but as this absolutely tyrannical Jupiter who hurled this thunderbolt that sent him into exile and is full of wrath. At the same time he's doing that, he's saying, and you're the most merciful and clement and wise and just ruler. Like, that's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. But then with his metaphors, he's saying, yeah, and you're this irascible tyrant who punished me for something that was really trivial.
I mean, the argument basically is you're being unfair, right? I just kind of feel like if the point was really to get back in his good graces, he might instead have talked about how handsome he was rather than pointing out all the flaws of his moral reasoning.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
But again, I think the premise of the Tristia is that you shouldn't punish me for writing this poem about sex because every single poem is about sex. You look at Virgil's Aeneid, it's all about Virgil brings his arms in the man right into Dido's bedroom. And that's the part everybody reads.
Right.
Which, it's funny because it's true. Like, that was the most read part of the Aeneid.
Right. You
know, from St. Augustine. Or if you look at architecture, you have the Temple of Mars Ultor and the Temple of Venus Genetrix in the center of Rome. And what is that but just this adultery mime where Mars and Venus are committing adultery with one another? So he's taking all of Roman religion, all of Roman topography and architecture and literature and saying, look, it's all about sex. So why blame me? Mm-hmm.
So for someone who's never read Ovid before, someone listening to this and has never read Ovid, are these poems typical or are these really different?
So I would say the Ars Amatoria is similar in tone to his Amores. So his first work was basically these love elegies, a lot of which he then, in the Ars Amatoria, he uses that as part of his data. So yeah, I would say it's somewhat different in tone from a lot of his stuff. I mean, he's writing in, the genre is didactic poetry, as opposed to love poetry or whatever the more metamorphoses is, epic, a big sprawling epic. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhat different, but he's using a lot of the material he uses in other poems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I also mentioned earlier that I kept thinking about Walker Percy when I was reading this, and I also kept thinking of Oscar Wilde. Mm-hmm. I don't know why exactly my mind went in those two directions, but it did.
Because they're funny and witty.
They
and
are super
satirical.
Funny.
Yeah.
And I think they're playing around with similar themes. I think about Love in the Ruins and the Love Clinic, send up of attempts to scientifically study love.
Yes.
As if that's going to be a serious thing. And then also he's just, Walker Percy is such a deeply satirical writer. Mm-hmm.
And like Lost in the Cosmos, it has the genre of self-help book, right?
Right, but it's a send-up.
But it's a send-up of it.
And of course, in Oscar Wilde too, there's this idea of art for art's sake and art is just about the beautiful and it's not didactic. So I just find myself coming back around to this question, like, is part of the thing that's being mocked the didactic genre?
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is, though, the didactic genre itself often, there's some funny stuff in there, or people wrote didactic poetry about all kinds of things. Most of those poems are lost to us, but they would write a didactic poem about how to play some obscure board game or something. One of the poems actually that lies behind this is a didactic poem by Nicander, who's a Greek poet of the probably second century BC, who wrote a poem about poisonous snakes. And then he wrote another poem about antidotes, which very broadly is the Ars Amatoria versus Theramidia Amoris, right? Mm-hmm. First, you write a poem about all these terrible poisons, and then about here's how you combat them. Mm-hmm. Well, it's difficult to read because it's got all this vocabulary about snakes. But what's funny is that it's this creepy and disgusting subject matter written in this very elegant, artistic Greek, right? So to some extent, the genre of didactic, where you're taking some either very quotidian or disgusting or technical thing, and you're putting it into this beautiful art form. In itself, there's something funny about that, because if you were to take a physics textbook and write it all in iambic pentameters, it would be funny. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to try to start to close things out, I can't help but come back to Plato. Where really is beauty in all of this for him? Especially in terms of how he thinks of his art in the sense not of the art of love, but the art of the poet. Is he seeing that connection between love and beauty that is in that Platonic tradition? Can we even extract that from this work or not?
Wow. That's a great question and a hard question.
Yeah. Sorry. I just have to ask the philosophical questions.
No, that's good. You are a philosopher. I think for Ovid, the beauty is in the art itself. It's in the poem. Mm-hmm. He talks about female beauty all the time. There is this constant analogy also between the human body and a work of art. Mm-hmm. And the way you groom and polish and comb and adorn a human person is also what he's doing to his poetry. Mm-hmm. So there's that analogy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm thinking back to Walker Percy's Lost in the Cosmos and how it's a so-called self-help book that teaches you that you can't help yourself. Mm-hmm. You need God's grace.
Right.
Turns out that's... That's what you learn if you read if you read Lost in the Cosmos with any modicum of understanding of it.
Right.
It's also deeply hilarious. So we talked about the Ars Amatoria as teaching you how not to love. I also wonder if it's teaching you how not to read. And one reason why I asked this question is you talked about how all of his data is from the literary tradition and how he's purposefully misusing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So is it also teaching you how to read by teaching you how not to read?
I think that's a great way of putting it. One of the funniest things to me about this poem is the egregiously boneheaded, ridiculous readings that he has of literature, which makes it so obvious that he is the bogus teacher, the unreliable narrator par excellence. Mm-hmm. He narrates the episode of the rape of the Sabine women from the beginning of Roman history, where Romulus realized he didn't have any women in his new state, so they have to bring all these Sabine women in from a neighboring town. And there's all kinds of issues that it raises, and the women are afraid, and he says, and maybe fear even made them more attractive, and there's all this kind of cringeworthy stuff, and this consideration. I mean, this was like one of the founding episodes of Roman history, and it's the relationship between the sexes. And the moral that the narrator, who's called the Praeceptor Amoris, the tutor of love, draws at the end is, wow, Romulus, you really know how to give soldiers benefits.
Yeah.
Give me benefits like that and I'll join the army.
Mm-hmm.
So even when he narrates the myth of Daedalus and Icarus and the labyrinth and all this, it was this prolonged meditation on art and philosophy and all these things. And the moral he draws is, well, Minos couldn't keep a winged man down and I'm trying to detain a winged god. These reductive conclusions to these mythological and literary and historical exemplar that he gives, it is a lesson in how not to read.
So I'll give you the last word. What would you say to someone who hasn't read any Ovid about why they should?
Because he's so funny.
It is really funny.
I mean, because he's so funny and because, like I said, I think it is so relevant to our time. I mean, the whole idea of, yeah, the artifaction of the self and this meditation on what art actually is and teaching people how to read well.
Mm-hmm.
That to read well, you can't just take what people say at face value.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
I love it. Thank you so much for coming on. This was also really fun.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
You have been listening to Sacred and Profane Love, a podcast hosted by the Honors College at the University of Tulsa. To learn more about the Honors College, please go to our website, utulsa.edu/honors. To learn more about this podcast, you can check out its website, sacredandprofanelove.com. On the website, you'll find an archive of all our past episodes and guests, and also a blog where we post news related to the work that we do. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter, where our handle is @eudaimoniapod. Finally, if you would like to support this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/eudaimoniapod. Patrons receive podcast swag and subscriptions with our literary partners, The Point Magazine, Switchyard Magazine, and The Lamp Magazine. We are grateful to our partners for their ongoing support.